Hello and welcome to Chalk Talk. Today we've got award-winning journalist Rania Abouzeid talking about life, loss and hope in wartime Syria.
Thank you. I'm honoured to give the director's lecture and I hope I can live up to it. So I'm a journalist by trade, and the title of this talk, I have to apologise, I don't have slides, and that is partly for security reasons, because many of the people in my book cannot be identified for their own security, and there are no photos in the book either. So the title of this talk is the title of my book. And I guess a pretty good place to start is with a confession. I didn't want to write a book about Syria. I had covered Syria since the first demonstrations. I happened to be in Damascus in February 2011, and I witnessed the first demonstrations. And I covered the country very intensely ever since. I knew that whatever was going to happen in Syria wasn't going to be contained to Syria, given its geostrategic importance. Whatever happened, if Assad survived, if he fell, it was going to have ramifications well beyond Syria's borders. So I stuck with the story. In summer 2011, I learned that I'd been blacklisted by the regime, but not as a journalist. Instead, they'd branded me a spy. They said that I worked for the Saudis, and American Ambassador Robert Ford, a man I'd never met until many years later when I was at a talk with him, and I said, "It's very nice to meet you. You're apparently my handler." It was really a work of creative fiction. But it also meant that I was banned from entering the country and that I was placed on the wanted lists of three of the four main intelligence agencies. So that meant I had to be smuggled in from Turkey. And that's how I covered Syria. And I was spending about 3 weeks of every month either inside Syria in various parts or on the borders trying to get in. So after doing that for years, the idea of writing a Syria book didn't exactly thrill me. I'd already lived it very intensely once, and I didn't want to relive it in book form. But two things changed my mind. The first was when the United Nations declared, and this was in early 2014, they declared that as of mid-2013, they'd stopped counting Syria's dead because of the difficulty of verifying information. That's how vicious this war is. And all of a sudden, Syrians, like so many people around the world, they're often referred to as casualty figures. They were not even numbers. And the second thing was when, in 2015, we saw the refugee crisis in Europe, when we saw Syrians heading from the Middle East towards Europe. And after an initial welcome, we saw the rise of the right and the calls to turn back people. And I figured, do these people know what some of these Syrians are fleeing? Do they think that they're coming here because they want a job? Do they think they're putting kids in rubber dinghies, knowing that their kids might drown because they want a welfare check? So I wrote a book about Syria because I wanted to take people there. I wanted you to see something of what Syrians saw. And the book follows four main people. They're no composite characters, they're all real. They're all people I spend a lot of time with. And you follow them over, or their families, some of them don't make it. You follow them over 6 years, and you get a sense of what they saw. And they're from all sorts of different parts of Syria geographically and also politically. And meanwhile, that's one layer of the book. And the other one is where I sort of untangle some of the background, and I take you into some of the backroom dealings and show you how it was armed, what the Saudis and the Qataris and the Turks and the Brits and the Americans did in those back rooms, and how the Islamists exploited the conflict. So Syria has been in the headlines, but why did it all happen? And to know that, I'm a big believer in history, because you can't understand the present unless you know the past. It is an integral part of everything that I do as a journalist. You have to understand the context of something. And Syria's recent history was shaped by one man, Hafez al-Assad, who was Bashar's father and predecessor. Hafez al-Assad was a poor man. He was a member of the Alawite sect, which is a very distant offshoot of Shia Islam. But throughout the history of the Alawites, they've been persecuted by both Sunni and Shia Muslims because they're not considered, quote-unquote, people of the book. The Jews and Christians are people of the book. The Alawites were considered heretics, so they were persecuted for that. So in Syria, they were basically second-class citizens. And this is the time after the French Mandate, And the military was generally shunned by the Sunni mercantile class and the rich Christians as a poor man's job. So it was a ticket for Alawites. It was, you know, their main ticket to social mobility. And Hafez al-Assad entered the Air Force. And by 1963, he had become the head of the Air Force. And that is the same year that his Ba'ath Party came to rule Syria. And the Ba'ath Party espoused, like many parties in the Middle East around the 50s and the 60s, it had a very romantic, secular ideology. This is a Middle East that is emerging from the trauma of colonialism. And it told people, you're not just Alawites or Sunnis or Christians, you are Syrians. So it was this big secular nationalist kind of push, and we saw it in Egypt with Gamal Abdel Nasser and with others. So the Ba'ath Party was that kind of a party. And Hafez al-Assad in November 1970 staged a coup against his own party, and that's when the Assad rule started in Syria. And what he did to cement his rule was that he set up a system of these intelligence agencies that I was talking about, and there were four main ones. So it was a rule underpinned by fear. From 1963 all the way to 2011, Syria was ruled by an emergency law. And what that law meant was that you knew that your phones were tapped, all mail was intercepted and read, the media was censored pre-publication, and public gatherings were banned. You needed official permission to gather, which is, by the way, one of the reasons why many of the protests came out of mosques, because under the emergency law, the mosques were among the few public gathering places where people could actually gather. So this was the state of Syria in 2011. Now, let me just take you back all those years. I know that it seems like a lifetime ago. It certainly does to me. I was in Tunisia. I covered the uprising in Tunisia. From Tunisia, I made my way over to Egypt, where I watched how Mubarak fell after 18 days of protests in Tahrir Square. And I was working for Time magazine. And my editor said, do you want to go to Libya? Because the eastern parts of Libya had just opened up. And I said, I want to go to Damascus and see how Damascus is responding, if at all. So I made my way over to Damascus in February 2011. And the thing about what was happening in 2011, this great explosion, like, why did it happen? Well, to give you an idea of the demographics, at least about a third of Middle Easterners are under 30. And in some places, two-thirds of people are under 25. And this was a generation, unlike their parents' generation, that had agreed to this social contract between the ruler and the ruled, had basically had enough, and their social contract had broken down. That contract was that these ruling regimes would provide bread instead of democracy. They'd give you a semblance of security. They'd give you, in exchange for state subsidies. And this is one of the great contradictions of Syria, for example. It was a place where the intelligence agents of these four agencies didn't even have to hide what they were doing. They weren't secret police. They didn't have to, because under the law, they could not be tried, even, quote, for crimes committed while undertaking their duties. So this, they didn't need to hide. You could see them in the cafes. It was funny. There were the guys who would sit at the cafe, and they wouldn't really order anything, but a cup of coffee would come, and every waiter would come and whisper in their ear. And they usually wore black leather jackets. That was the joke. That was their uniform. So you knew them. You could see them. They didn't fear you. So this social contract was broken. Unemployment was high. Young men couldn't marry and move out of their homes. So this pent-up frustration just exploded. And in Syria, it started very timidly. It started with the protest that I witnessed, which is where my book starts. And it was in front of the Libyan embassy. And a very small group of small, but in terms of what was happening in Syria at the time, it was pretty big. It was about 200 people. And they had gathered in front of the Libyan embassy to express solidarity with Libyan protesters, knowing that Assad, Bashar al-Assad, couldn't really stand Gaddafi. So they were sort of in line with their leader's foreign policy. And they were vastly outnumbered by the security forces who had assembled, and that protest was violently broken up. 14 young men were arrested that night, and afterwards I spoke to a number of them about what had happened. And that was the beginning. That was the first real attempt, or one of the first major attempts, to push the envelope, to see what they could get away with in terms of public gatherings, to put a toe over the red line that had been so deeply etched in Syrian memory. And this is also where history comes in, because every Syrian knew what the price of dissent would be in his or her state, because they had historical examples. And one of the strongest was what happened in Hama in 1982, when Hafez al-Assad put down an Islamist insurrection that was led by the Muslim Brotherhood. And he put it down by basically going house to house in Hama and killing an unknown, you know, this happened in a vacuum. The estimates are anywhere from 7,000 to 30,000 people. And when I snuck into Hama in the summer of 2011, some of the survivors showed me where the mass graves were. And they were, Hafez al-Assad had such disdain for his enemies, even in death, that he paved over them. In some places, he put a market on top of the mass graves. In another place, he put a hotel. I mean, he didn't even want it to be like a memorial of any type so that people couldn't pray over their dead. But the survivors remembered where they were. That was one example. The second was in 2004. When in Syria, Kurds, even if they were born in Syria, were stateless. They weren't allowed to teach their language. They weren't allowed to speak it. They didn't even have citizenship, even if they were born in the country. And in 2004, a Syrian leader started, you know, pushing for these rights. And that protest movement was violently repressed as well. So Syrians could point to these two examples, and they knew the price of dissent in their state. So in the same time that the Libyan embassy protest was happening, a group of kids, young people actually, in the southern city of Dar'a, which borders Jordan, were rounded up and they were accused of writing anti-regime graffiti on a number of school walls. And I tracked down some of the kids. One of them is in the book. And he had nothing to do with the graffiti. He just happened to be playing soccer that night after school in one of the schoolyards. And they came to his house, the Mukhabarat, knocked on his door, and he was hauled in to the dungeons of the Syrian secret police. So many of these kids were from one of the major clans down in Dar'a. It's called the Abbasids, no relation. And their family members started calling for their release. And they were big clans, so they took to the streets. And they first asked the governor. The governor wouldn't respond. So they took to the streets and they started agitating for their kids' release, because these kids were moving through the secret police facilities. And news of their treatment, real and embellished, a lot of it was exaggerated, started to emerge. So that is why Dar'a was christened the birthplace of the revolution, because those protests soon spread across the country. Assad had given an interview to the Wall Street Journal, by the way, in January of 2011, and he had said that he was sitting pretty in Damascus. He said that Syria was different. He said Syria was different in part because he believed that his anti-Israel, anti-Western sort of stance was in keeping with Syrian public opinion, and also because he was only 45 at the time, and he was a lot younger than the Mubaraks and the other dictators. And he had, quote, only been in power for 11 years at that time. In many ways, Assad was right. Syria was different, because what happened in Syria, and I'm not exaggerating, it had ripple effects all over the world. It enabled the rise of Islamic State. It enabled Al-Qaeda to rejuvenate and to recruit and then to split and become Islamic State. It displaced half of a country of 23 million people. Can you hold that figure in your head for a second? Imagine that half the room is displaced. And they're either displaced internally within their borders or externally. There are millions of people in Syria's neighboring states. I mean, it's so bad that the UN has said that it's the worst refugee crisis since the end of World War II. So why did we get to this stage? In many parts of the Middle East, these initial sort of protests were led by secular activists. They were very spontaneous. They were leaderless. They weren't organized. And they were soon, they were violently repressed as well. Like, I remember walking in protests and hearing the gunshots. And I tell you, I'm not kidding, that in some places, people didn't even break their step. They kept walking. There were, another people were being shot dead, and a cycle soon set in. The cycle was that a protest would result in deaths. After the deaths, there'd be a funeral. The funeral would become a protest. All it took is a few chants for the funeral to become a protest. That would be violently repressed, and the cycle would repeat. In the middle of all of this madness, opportunistic Islamism stepped into this space. The Islamists were organized. The Islamists had been repressed. The Islamists had underground networks. And when that repression was lifted, they rebounded. They rebounded everywhere across the Middle East. But I want to be clear, an Islamist is not an Islamist is not an Islamist. It's a spectrum. And the Islamists of Tunis, for example, are not the same as the Islamists of Egypt, who are not the same as the many different factions of Islamists in Syria. So they were all very different. I mean, it's so different that Al-Qaeda came to fight Islamic State in Syria. That's how different some of these Islamist groups were in terms of what they were doing. So Syrian men started to pick up arms. And how did it start? So a man would buy a gun. And Syria, by the way, was not one of these Middle Eastern states where guns are like, you know, basically in every home like a lamp. In Syria, gun ownership was very tightly controlled. So people start, but Syria also has many borders with lots of other countries where you can buy guns. So weapons started coming in from Turkey, from Lebanon, from Jordan, from Iraq. Men started buying guns initially to protect themselves, their families. Their brothers would buy a gun, their cousins would buy a gun, their neighbors would buy a gun. And pretty soon these groups started adopting military nomenclature. Initially, they just called themselves groups. Like I remember in Homs, there was one group that was called the Taiba group because it was near Taiba Patisserie. But then after a while, they started adopting the military nomenclature. And we saw the entry of the Lebanese, the Saudis, the Qataris, the Turks, the Brits, the Americans on the rebel side. And on the other side, the Lebanese, again, different factions, Hezbollah, the Iranians, and the Russians, and you know, initially as advisors, but later in September 2015, as we saw Russian planes and fighter pilots over the skies of Syria. So we you know, and in the book I went back and traced like when the first weapons came in, who the Saudis dealt with, what they promised, what the Qataris said, and how they acted at cross purposes, even though they were on the same side, and they made rebel factions compete for supplies. They pitted them against each other. In some cases, even as publicly they told them to unite. Helicopter gunships took to the skies, and I remember when they first took to the skies, you could actually kind of make out the pilot. And then the rebels started getting bigger and bigger and bigger anti-aircraft guns, and they started flying higher and higher and higher. Al-Qaeda, meanwhile, was quietly planning. Al-Qaeda in Syria, which was called Jabhat al-Nusra, started from a seed of 8 men. And there were 6 men who came across the border in August 2011, and they'd been dispatched by Abu Bakr al-Baghdadi, a name you may know from the news. And he was, at the time, the head of the Islamic State of Iraq, which once upon a time was Al-Qaeda in Iraq. And he sent these 6 men, and they were met by 2 others who were waiting for them on the other side in August 2011. And they were given instructions to hook up with some Islamists whom Assad was releasing from prisons. And the main prison was called Saydnaya prison. They had a floor, and I talked to some of the guys who were in there. And the floor that they were on, they said that they called it like the black door because it was the jihadi wing. And everybody behind it was a presumed jihadi. Many of them were men who had fought with Al-Qaeda in Fallujah in Iraq. Many others were guys who were on their way to fighting the Americans in Iraq, but they were picked up beforehand. So these were men who had spent a lot of time behind bars getting to know each other. They were, in effect, a ready-made network of vetted men. These Al-Qaeda leaders hooked up with the men who were being released. And they very slowly started, I mean, they kept their Al-Qaeda ties hidden. They didn't reveal that they were part of Al-Qaeda, but they slowly started to sort of ingratiate themselves in the armed Syrian rebellion. And they were very effective fighters because they were disciplined. Because any man who joined Jabhat al-Nusra, which was secretly Al-Qaeda in Iraq, had to pledge loyalty. And it was a religious oath that he would listen and obey his commander. The other groups of the so-called Free Syrian Army were pretty ragtag. They didn't follow anybody's orders except for their own. They might coordinate with some of the other groups that were either in their vicinity or in nearby towns, but that was about the extent of any anything that we know as an army chain of command. Meanwhile, foreign fighters started streaming in. And you could see them. I remember so many times when I'd be at the... you could see them on the domestic flights from Istanbul going down into the Turkish border towns that were jumping off points for various parts of Syria. And they weren't hiding what they were doing. They spoke a variety of Arabic dialects. There were some that I heard who had very British accents. There was one time when three Albanians were standing in front of me. And they weren't hiding what they were doing. I mean, they were men with long beards and really short pants. You couldn't not know what they were doing, so much so that in my book, one of my key characters is a senior member of Al-Qaeda. He was really angry with why these men weren't following instructions to tone down their appearances at the Turkish airports. But they didn't care, and nor did the Turks. So we saw these foreign fighters coming in as well. Some of them came just because they were sick of seeing Syrians dying on the nightly news. Others came because they wanted to turn Syria, cosmopolitan Syria, into an Islamic state. And they often hooked up with the Al-Qaeda affiliate, but there were also other ultra-conservative Salafi groups that they hooked up with. So in early 2013, Abu Bakr al-Baghdadi tells his Nusra, which is very successful, by the way. They would send their men to military training camps. They'd work on their mind before they worked on their military prowess. And they would not accept anybody. A recruit had to be recommended by one of their members. Once again, that ready-made network of people they could trust. So as opposed to like other battalions of the Free Syrian Army where they were desperate for numbers so they could be on YouTube and say, I have 300 men behind me, and that was a way for them to get sponsors. That, you know, there would be rich sheikhs in the Gulf who would say, I'll back that battalion. And we started to see the fragmentation of the rebel force because people were competing for supplies, they were competing for supporters, they were competing because the Saudis and the Turks and the Qataris had pitted them against each other. So so Jabhat al-Nusra was always very disciplined. So with time, like many revolutions, it started to eat its children. And we saw rebel battalions turn on each other because of that competition, in part because of the prestige of a particular commander's, a particular commander for his reputation and things like this. And we saw rebels fighting rebels. And that's one of the reasons why I think that sectarianism is an often lazy label for many of these conflicts because, you know, superficially, is it the Alawite president Hafez Bashar al-Assad against the Sunni rebels? No, not really. Because most of the Syrian army is Sunni. Because most Syrians are Sunni. I think that sectarianism is often a... It's not about sectarianism, it's about good old power. And anything that you can point to the other person and say, that person is not like me, whether that's a religious difference, socioeconomic, geographical, anything that says, this person is not like me, is something that a leader is going to use to dehumanize the other. Because you can't kill somebody that you can relate to who is like you. It's harder. It's harder to do. You have to start, and it starts with language. It starts with dehumanizing language as well. So, I mean, most of Islamic State's victims, for example, were Muslims. And Sunni Muslims at that. So, I think we have to be careful with the labeling of these things. So, the refugees flooded out. And mainly to Syria's neighboring states. I mean, the so-called refugee crisis in Europe isn't really in Europe. About 1 million people applied for asylum in Europe. Turkey alone hosts about 3.8 million Syrians. That's the largest refugee population in the world. Lebanon, where I'm based, at one point every fourth person was Syrian. Can you imagine that? Every fourth person was Syrian. In Jordan, which is water parched, water starved, it's had to share its meager resources with more Syrians. So much so that one of the camps that they set up there, Za'atari, was at one point, by the numbers, Jordan's fourth largest city. This is where the refugee crisis is. So people obviously tried to escape that to Europe, and we know what happened there. And I would argue, actually, that you could probably draw a line between the influx of refugees into Europe and the rise of the right, or the rhetoric, the public rhetoric, and not just in Europe. I mean, look at the US as well. So, where are we now? 2019 and Syria is a fragmented state. Assad, the war continues, but for all intents and purposes, Assad has won. Assad and his allies have won, that's just a fact. But it's still a very messy place. There are parts of Syria controlled by Assad. There are parts that are parts that were actually controlled by Islamic State, like Raqqa and what have you, the eastern parts, that are now Kurdish controlled. And that's where Trump's US forces are, and every day he says he's going to withdraw them or he's not. It depends on his Twitter mood. And the other part is Idlib, and that's a province, and it's a big province. It borders Turkey, and it's where most of Assad's opponents have been pinned. And it is run by some of these ultra-conservative, basically Al-Qaeda types, even if they don't call themselves that. But it's also home to many civilians who feel stuck between the jihadis, a regime that has spent years trying to kill them, and don't want to be part of either. The thing about Idlib is that since 2014, you know, that fluid Turkish border that I was talking about that was very easy to cross, since 2014, the Turks, under pressure from the international community to hem the jihadists inside Syria, started erecting a concrete wall. And it's a massive, massive project. I mean, I think there's about 900 kilometers of wall between Syria and Turkey. And they topped it with coiled razor wire and instituted a shoot-to-kill policy. And that is still in place, which basically means that Syrians are, in Idlib anyway, are stuck. So why does it matter to you here in this gorgeous, peaceful, green valley? Because the world really is a small place. What happened in Syria didn't stay in Syria. We know that from the rise of Islamic State. Those attacks also happened here too. We know that from the refugee crisis, and we know that also because many of your foreign policies that your government makes have an impact over there, and they're policies that are made in your name. You know, before 2003, there was the US invasion of Iraq, for example. There was no Al-Qaeda in Iraq. Al-Qaeda, of course, was the precursor to Islamic State of Iraq. I mean, like, Iraqis remember. Yemenis will remember that British bombs are falling on them. These are policies that are made in your name. It's the world is too small for us to look away and say, well, these things are happening over there. They won't affect us over here. History, again, teaches us that blowback is an ugly thing. Turning to Islamic State, as we all know, the so-called caliphate was physically destroyed, but the group hasn't been destroyed, because how do you destroy an ideology? It's difficult to kill. The legacy of the group lives on. It lives on in many ways. It lives on in the 200-plus mass graves that the UN has identified in only in parts of Iraq, not even in Syria, that Islamic State once controlled. And some of the exhumations have started in the Yazidi villages. It lives on in families that are broken, in Yazidi women who were sexually enslaved and who some of whom, thousands of whom, are still missing. It lives on in broken broken communities, especially between, for example, Yazidis and their Arab neighbors. These broken places where it's hard to see how these people will become neighbors again. And it also lives on in these thousands of foreign fighters who, including from the UK, and nobody really knows what to do with them. I know that your government has stripped some of them of citizenship, but ironically, that actually plays into Islamic State's propaganda, because Islamic State used to talk about eliminating what it called the gray zone. And the gray zone is basically a multi-ethnic, multi-plural society. And it used to, it actually published reports about this, and its message to Muslims was, you don't belong there. It doesn't matter if you're born there, they'll never accept you. Come to us. So, I'm not a lawyer, I don't know, I'm not on the opinion pages, I'm just on the news, I'm just putting the question out there and letting you know what this group was saying. And what to do with the thousands who are in these tent cities? I mean, history, again, has told us that keeping these people in isolation, such as in Saydnaya prison, or the Iraqi version of Saydnaya was Camp Buka, which was down near the Kuwaiti desert and it was run by the US, actually. That's actually where Abu Bakr al-Baghdadi was held. So the leader of Islamic State was in this US-run prison. So were many other leaders of the Islamic State. Again, a ready-made network of vetted men. Keeping them in isolation, their ideas only become more concentrated. So what to do with the thousands of people who once lived under this so-called caliphate? Men, women, and children. How are they going to be reintegrated into society? How are their ideas going to be changed? You might think that, you know, these things happen in pretty messed up places very far away, but I would say that maybe even in a state like the US, or the rise of populist leaders, even here and elsewhere, shows us that democracy is a pretty fragile thing. And when a strong-headed leader, say, for example, like Trump, he's exposed the limits of state institutions just with his Twitter handle. Democracy is precious. Consider the impact, for example, of a US president who uses the same phrase that Stalin used, enemies of the people, to describe members of the press he doesn't like. We have already seen that, I mean, the implications are borderless. We've already seen both Assad and the Egyptian leader Sisi refer to fake news when it comes to human rights reports that they don't like. I mean, this sets the bar. What it says is, oh, see, even in the US there's fake news. Trump is talking about it, so this report about us is also fake news. I mean, the repercussions are borderless. Words are powerful. Language has consequences. Like I said, it's often the first step in dehumanizing your enemy. We are interconnected in many ways, big and small. Over there is not so far away from over here. We can't afford to look away from a world that is impacting our world here too. And history reminds us that it's all connected. Thank you.
Well, that's it for today. But there's plenty more for you to enjoy at cvhf.org.uk or wherever you get your podcasts. Thank you for listening.